The views and opinions expressed on this podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not reflect the views or endorsement of any entity. Nothing being said on this podcast should be considered as investment advice.
Another Friday morning. In the hot seat with me is the one and only Eli. Eli, how you doing, buddy?
Let's go. Just got back from Tokyo. Amazing trip.
We've got a lot to talk about.
We do.
I know K-Row is out today.
Yep.
We thought we'd fill in the GOAT who was in Tokyo. We've also got a special guest. I'll let you tease him in a minute.
Yep.
And then the third co-host for today, the one, the only, the man with the math. That's Sam, NFT Statistics. How you doing, Sam?
What's up, guys? How you doing?
The slight delay. What's up is the best.
We like it. What were we gonna say, Sam? How are you doing, man?
I'm good. It's always fun to be here with you guys.
This is gonna be a fun one. Well, let's not delay. We're live. We've got a great show ahead. Why don't we kick it off with Tokyo? Because you just got back. I was just chatting with folks. I mean, like the thing I keep hearing was how awesome Bright Moments in Tokyo really was these last couple of weeks. Why don't you kick us off and share a little bit?
Yeah. So, was there for Bright Moments Tokyo. And you know, the thing I come away with from those 3, 4, 5 days was it really felt like we were part of a movement, you know, and like when you're behind your screen and you're on Twitter, there's an element of that. But being surrounded by collectors and artists and in these different environments that we'll talk about throughout the show, it really felt like this is an art movement. And, you know, the people there are really the catalyst for that in many ways. And like, that's what this experiential part of this space allows for someone to experience and feel and be reminded of, really. So that was sort of the primary takeaway, is like, setting aside the market and the commodification of these works, it's really about the people, the artwork, the technology, and the relationships in many ways. Yeah. And like, I keep coming back to this idea of, you know, we're seeing the same people IRL a couple times a year now in 5 years and 10 years. Like, you know, you foster real relationships with people over time. So Seth is going to join us from Bright Moments later in the show. And we'll dig into all things Bright Moments, but a great couple of days out there.
That's awesome. And we'll kick off the show with a slightly different topic. I think we'll start broad and then narrow down as we go through. Sam, you have been relentlessly staying on top of the data over the last couple of months. You're surfacing some great insights in your dailies. I thought it would be great to kind of kick off and set the stage for today's show just with a quick update on the market. We can spend a couple of minutes on this, but why don't you jump in and tell us what you're seeing on chain?
Sure. I mean, I think I kind of divide the market into three buckets. The first is kind of the PFP stuff that's now mostly traded on Blur. The second is art blocks and GMDAO and kind of brain drops and a bit more of those kind of collections of art projects. And then the last is one of ones. And I think what jumps out at me about art blocks and one of ones is just how much volumes are down, you know? So every day I'm highlighting the top 4 art block sales in my, you know, on my show. And, you know, we've had a few days in a row where no project other than Chromie Squiggles did more than 5 ETH of volume. You know, it used to be like when I started this kind of segment of the show, it would be like 10 different projects were doing 10 ETH more of volume. And that was already felt down, but now there's just very little liquidity there. So that's one of the themes that I've kind of seen. And I think we're seeing the same thing in one-on-ones. You know, it's like we get the occasional XCopy sale, like on secondary, or Sam Spratt, you know, he hasn't done something in a while, but there are a couple of people who are still commanding like serious prices. But we're seeing a lot of one-on-ones for people who have had sales in like the 20 to 30 range coming in like the 5 to 10 range, or just not that many sales. So I think it starts out with a little bit less volume and then prices go lower. So that's kind of been a theme in the art space. I think in the PFP space, we've actually, over the past week, we've had a bit of a rebound. You're starting to see some stories pop up that people are getting excited about. So like Memeland has been completely on fire with Captains and Pudgy Penguins. You know, Pudgy Penguins, of course, had They launched their toy yesterday, which just got a lot of people excited about the story. And
I saw
the price
you buy one, Sam.
From 4 to 4.8 ETH. So there's been a lot of cool stuff happening, I think, in the PFP space. The other thing we've seen is that volumes have come down. And I actually think that volumes down is a good thing. The reason for that is, at least when you're talking about PFPs, and the reason is over the past, you know, few months, like 80% of high-end PFP volume has been on Blur. And like over the past month, at least more than half of the trades are people dumping into bids. And I think that that has broadly scared people away and made people like just kind of less interested in the space, or, you know, I think rightly, it just made people hesitant to want to buy because you know that there are kind of these supply blocks lurking that could dump so quickly. So I think kind of the first step towards normalization and people getting more confident is seeing volumes come down a bit, even though they're already very low, just fewer people dumping into bids. And we're seeing that, like, as volumes have come down, prices have stabilized a little bit. So overall, I'd say those are kind of like the main trends, you know, a few secular stories, really low volume for the art space, and PFPs showing a little bit of hope. Like we've just seen a little bit of, I don't know, a little bit of positive energy kind of in pockets here. 0-1 Force, of course, another one that's gone from like 0.9 to 1.5 ETH. So, you know, just a few secular kind of stories that seem positive.
Before we jump into one of those categories in particular, I think we'll spend a little bit more time on art blocks. And we'll tease through the volume, and then we'll kind of tee it up for some of the 3AC stuff that's coming down the pike here. I'm curious, when you look at things like ACK's, you know, big sale 2 weeks ago, or you look at Milady's, you know, up to 4.5 or 5 ETH or wherever the heck those things are, or you look at $8 million being sent to Ben.eth. I guess, like, what are these markers of, in your view, Sam? Because I totally agree with you. Like, vols are all low right now on some of the collections that I think everyone would deem to be quite significant. And we can, like, talk about that here in a minute. But in terms of primary appetite and also some of like the speculative behavior that, you know, it continues to exist, I'm curious what you make of some of these signs and what you think that means. Are these leading indicators? Are these lagging indicators? How are you taking this information and running it through your mental models for what happens next?
You know, I'd put captains in that bucket too. You know, captains mm-hmm. have gone from 4 to 9 ETH. You know, I don't think the issue right now is that people don't have ETH to spend. Like, we are, like, this is very different. You know, the last time NFTs went down as much as they've gone down over the past 3 months, the last time that happened was the Luna collapse. And at that point, people were like, damn, I need to get out of NFTs so I can pay my rent. Like, that was like, I'm worried about liquidity in my native currency that I need to get by. I think it's a very different environment right now. Like, over the past 3 months, you know, triple Qs, like NASDAQ is doing very well. S&P 500, you know, has had a pretty strong stretch. Like, risk parameters like the VIX are pretty low. Ethereum and Bitcoin have done fine. You know, it hasn't been a super volatile period for it. I mean, it's been, you know, Bitcoin and crypto and Ethereum are always volatile, but relatively speaking, it hasn't been terrible. I think that people have ETH right now. Mm. And one thing we know, certainly from the meme coin pump, is that people are willing to spend on a good gamble, on a good, you know, on something that's pumping. People, these are momentum assets. Like, people want to chase it. I think people have ETH to do it. I just think the biggest concern right now is that prices are going down and people don't want to chase stuff that's going down, you know, and we've seen that. I think this is one of the most interesting things about Blend, right? Is that people now have access to so much ETH, to so much liquidity, but Blend hasn't sent prices higher. You know, Bored Ape Yacht Club, Mutant Ape Yacht Club, Azuki, CryptoPunks, D-Gods, they're all down or flat versus when they launched on Blend, giving pretty much anyone capital who wanted it. And I think that what that shows us is that the hesitation isn't like people don't have the liquidity to buy. It's that they're concerned that the prices are going to go down, so they don't want to get involved. But when you see positive energy, when you see things where there's positive momentum, like Milady, you know, with Elon tweeting about it, like Captains, where there's meme land coming up, like Pepe the Token, like this piano set from ACK, who has a pretty impeccable track record, like, yeah, people are willing to spend ETH on it. And I don't think that's different now than it's ever been.
Yeah, makes total sense. So great analysis. Let's unpack some of this through the lens of a very specific collection that I think everyone on this show has thought a lot about, which is Artblocks and Artblocks Curated. Eli, I'm curious, maybe you can kind of piggyback from some of the things and notes that Sam has made and maybe share some of your opinions there on what's happening in that ecosystem right now.
Yeah, so I think there's, Sam, you so accurately touch on the volumes across those collections being way down, all things art blocks. And I think there are sort of two things that come to mind for me. Sort of, the first is, you know, 20 years ago, any generative art, computer art was conceptually interesting. Now, you know, I think a couple years into art blocks' lifespan, most of the low-hanging fruit conceptually has been picked off. And so in a bull market, that's okay, because sort of anything that comes from that brand and from the great artists who release work through the, in particular, the curated vertical thrives. In a down market, I think collectors start to do this calculus that's more nuanced. It's evaluating the brand of art blocks first and foremost, and then it's the conceptual nature of the work, it's the visual outputs themselves, it's the artist as a so-called marketer. And when you do that calculus and when you consider that wider set of considerations, the number of works and the number of collections that look really attractive across all of those dimensions is perhaps quite a bit smaller. And you know, I think art blocks did so well. And some of this, I think, and you can speak to this, Derek, was intentional and some was community driven, but to have these different sort of framings of collections. So we had season one and the season nomenclature and that framing or that wrapper. And by extension, you had collectors desiring full sets. With some of that going away as well, you know, I think it, those are interesting drivers of collectability as well. And so in a world where you have a down market and people are perhaps broadly avoiding these risk assets, as Sam always talks about, and collectors are doing this slightly more nuanced calculus on why something is interesting versus why maybe it's a little less interesting, you're seeing a lot less volume and many fewer collectors really leaning in, I think, on art blocks. And I think that ultimately probably changes, but it also, I think, is healthy for two reasons. I think both on the art block side, you know, really, and you're on the curatorial board, probably, I would imagine, really pushes you guys to ask those questions when you're doing curation, you know, from a conceptual basis. There's a release next week with Operator that I think hits all of these marks so effectively that we can maybe talk about. But also from a collector perspective, learning to do some of that calculus, consider these broader set of considerations instead of it's art blocks curated, so I'm going to mint, so it's going to be valuable. I think ultimately that will be healthy.
Yeah, these are all great points. I would say I don't largely disagree with any of those. I think to your point, in a time, and if I'm going to combine the feedback that I'm hearing from yourself and from Sam, it's like from a time where people are less likely to go out on the risk curve and find new artists or find new projects or find new collections to support. That level of sophistication around how they want to move money around in this space, the bar gets higher. And as a result, it's not that work doesn't sell or it can't be appreciated, but people are more concerted about and sophisticated about where and how they participate in these markets economically. I think that's right. Touching on, you know, something that you just said about this upcoming drop, maybe you can talk a little bit about Operator and I can jump in and why I might find that one a little interesting, but then I'd love to also return and shift away from the primary market in new buyers and new artists to the secondary market, where I know Sam has pulled some data. But first, I'd love to hear you riff on Operator, and I can chime in with some thoughts as well.
Yeah, so I'm interviewing Operator later today.
Cool.
And we'll have a podcast interview out with them, I think Tuesday, the day before their drop on Wednesday of next week. I met Anya in Tokyo. Actually, she was out there for Bright Moments. So I'll save most of the conversation there. But again, this is just you know, a project that blends deep sort of conceptual thinking, technology, but also visual output in a way that sort of combines to make, I think, a really compelling collection and project. But we'll dig in more a little bit over the course of the coming days.
Yeah. I've got just a quick, a fun story about this work in particular, which I'm also very excited about. When I first showed my wife the Chromie Squiggle in November of 2020, and I was explaining to her how this autonomous procedural rules-based system worked, where like my purchase was acted as the seed against this algorithm, and what I was presented with was, you know, purely based on chance. When I was explaining, she's a professional dancer, and trained and has thought very deeply about conceptual art, in the form of dance. She was like, oh, this is like Merce Cunningham. And Merce Cunningham, from having learned a little bit about Operator, is really one of the inspirations behind, their work and extending that form of chance and rules-based dance into now algorithmic art. And so I'm curious to see how the drop is, how it goes, and kind of dig into the technology behind what they're doing around chance and randomness in the form of motion capture and software against body movements, and translating that into a chance and rules-based art form on ArtBlock. So I'm excited about Operator as well. But transitioning over to the secondary market for ArtBlock, Sam, I know you've done some digging around some of the top collections on ArtBlock, what their current market caps look like, and where these things, how these things are currently being traded. So maybe you can riff a little bit on that.
We lost Sam's audio.
I think we lost your audio, Sam.
Oh, my bad. Let me get here. I can remove my screen. These are a couple of the charts we talked about yesterday, just total market cap. I think these five are the biggest in ArtBlock. I don't know if that resonates with you, Derek, but you know, Squiggles at 150 million market cap, Fidenza about 67 million, Ringers at 39, Gaze.
I think Elevated Deconstructions would be up there between 3 and 4, but this is largely right.
Got it. Yeah. So those, I mean, one of the interesting things happening right now is that very few are listed. You know, if like only 11 Fidenzas are listed, only 9 Ringers are listed, I believe. I think part of that, this is just on OpenSea.
Yeah.
I think part of that is kind of like exchange diversification happening. I think part of it is when there's so few trades, like listings just expire. You know, you have listings for 1 month to 3 months, you know, they just expire when there's so few trades that happen. You know, this is also kind of an interesting thing that's happening out there. And then this is a chart here that looks at the percentage of trades on ArtBlock that have been sellers selling into bids versus someone seeing a listing they like and buying it over the, and it's 1 month trailing. So over the past month, you know, half of the trades have been people who are just taking whatever liquidity they can get, as opposed to someone who is trading, you know, a buyer initiating the trade. So this is one of the kind of things. I don't know if I'd say worrying, it happens, but like just kind of when you look at the history of this collection, like it is very rare that to have something like this. I'm throwing one more chart on here, which is just total trade volume, 7-day trailing, and we're basically at the lowest that we've been. Which I just throwed in. So I think all of these just point to lack of activity, lack of liquidity, I think what Eli said really did resonate with me. I think there was a time where you thought you could buy stuff and you would have exit liquidity if you wanted it, and you were kind of just taking a bet on momentum, or you bought something because you liked it. And I think right now people are, when you buy something, you have to realize like, I might not have exit liquidity for a long time. And I think that kind of changes the calculus of when people like, you know, when people decide to buy an NFT in general. And you have to start thinking like, is this an NFT that I think has value in 5 to 10 years? Like, is this an artist who has established provenance in a way, or who has like built their personal following and reputation and shown an ability to stay relevant? Or is it a work that is so interesting it's going to stay relevant for a long time? You know, and I think that's one of the reasons that Chromie Squiggles have been a little bit stronger. I think it's just one of those collections. People just feel like it has its name etched in history a little bit, and it's just going to maintain that value for a long time. But those are some of the thoughts that kind of jumped to me when Eli, when I heard Eli saying what he was saying.
Yeah, I think Sam, just quickly, Derek, I think Sam, those two slides in parallel, the listing number and then followed by the WEETH versus ETH, like those tell a story together, right? Because as you show, most trades are happening through WEETH bids or accepting WEETH bids. And so listing becomes less of a, listing percentage becomes less of a meaningful metric, I think, in this case. Derek, quickly to you, I'm curious, based on everything sort of Sam showed and is talking about, who is a buyer, do you think, in this market? Like, what are those maybe segments of collectors who are maybe sort of consistently leaning in and sort of undeterred in this market? What do you see?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I'll say two things. The first thing I'll say will be a lead up to answering your actual question. But as I reflect on Sam's slides just now, it always dawns on me that for some of these collections, let's call it like the top 5 to 10 collections that have the largest market caps on our blocks, and I think about each collection as an economy, like these economies are actually quite small. It doesn't take a lot of new marginal buyers to actually move the price of these economies north. And so, recognizing that a number of these assets are trading at some, 5 to 10% discount from a WEETH bid from where the listing price is. The fact is, there's 5 pieces in certain collections that are up for sale, or in a 10,000 piece collection, there's less than 70 that are up for sale. And as I think about, the importance of some of these collections and the fact that new buyers will arrive in the future, given everything we know about the properties of this technology and this art form and where we're moving as a society, and the fact that the number of people that now own a digital object is skyrocketing, year over year. My view is like these economies are going to look much larger in a few years than they do today. That gets me to, how is that going to happen? Like who are these segments that are going to participate in these economies? Who are the marginal buyers today? And the truth is the marginal buyer today is probably someone who has a lot of capital and not a lot of exposure to these economies yet, but understands the vision of what I just proposed. And it's going to be, in large part, it's going to be funds. It's going to be high net worth individuals. It'll be contemporary art collectors who want to put a position on or get exposure to this digital wrapper and this asset class. And in that way, a lot of the next leg of the journey is educating and storytelling and explaining the properties of this technology and the importance of these collections and the things that, organizations like Art Blocks and Bright Moments and Super Rare are doing to be able to, adequately de-risk or explain or demonstrate the value of what we're all doing here. So the answer to your question, I think, is it's a combination of education, it's a combination of time, but in my view, these things are going to look much different in the next couple of years than they do today once some of these things start to ossify.
Yeah, I love that perspective. Very much related to everything, liquidity and volume and Art Blocks is, of course, the 3AC Sotheby's so-called Grails sale that's happening right now and over the course of the coming months. I think there's an auction or a sale ongoing at the moment with, I think, a 2 Fidenzas, a CryptoPunk,
a Glyph,
an Autoglyph, at least 1 Ringer.
Yeah. I think I saw a Squiggle in there too.
Is there a Squiggle?
I thought so.
Yeah.
I might be wrong about that, but we'll have to double check.
So there's a bunch of interesting dimensions of this that we could talk about. The first that comes to mind is provenance.
Yeah.
And, I think to sort of dovetail from your point, Derek, for large collectors in particular, but maybe more broadly, provenance of sort of prior ownership is incredibly important. And I've heard that directly from a number of the funds who are large collectors in this space. So I'm curious, in terms of provenance with these works from Dimitri and Tyler and Eric and Larva Labs, Matt and John, is the on-chain provenance of these works having been owned by 3AC, then sold through Sotheby's and transferred through that Sotheby's Grails wallet, is that part of an interesting story, or is that part of does that detract
From its value or enhance its value?
That's right. Yeah. What do you think?
Got a lot of thoughts on this one.
Yeah.
So when I think about provenance, I don't necessarily think that there's a clean answer. When I think of provenance, I think of it like just it's raw data, and it's the stories that we tell around that raw data that give something cultural value or significance or, detract from its overall value. And so when I think about Three Arrows Capital, Three Arrows, and what they stood for, and being this, you know, far out on the risk curve hedge fund, venture fund, that went way over leveraged, and the hubris and the lack of humility, but also the power that that organization had for years. They were considered, you know, one, a dominant force in our industry, only to, you know, go toe to toe with this technology and be completely wiped out and insolvent and have to file for bankruptcy. To me, there's such an interesting footnote in history with the fact that they had the capital, had the size, had the horsepower, and the, you know, the mental bandwidth to choose this collection specifically and assemble it at a time when, you know, the market was really starting to wrap their heads around how value will accrete to these things, that I certainly believe that there is an amazing story there that is being told through its on-chain provenance. And the fact that, you know, Sotheby's is stepping in and working with the trustee of the bankruptcy to be able to orderly, you know, bring these to market in a way that's thoughtful. I think, if anything, this highlights their collectability rather than detracts from it.
Yeah. Yeah, that made sense. I mean, we see obviously in the traditional art market that these types of stories can be additive in terms of value. Mm-hmm. The sort of far end of the spectrum is, you know, looting and stolen goods that then have a different framing around their future collectibility. I don't think that's quite the case here, but I think for some, well, I'll speak for myself.
Yeah,
I think I would rather not own a work that has that provenance relative to some of the other options, whether it's minting or you minted something and I buy it from you. That feels to me like a sort of perhaps it lacks some of that complexity, but for me that feels like a sort of a more pure ownership path that's attractive. That's I mean my perspective.
It's a good point. Yeah, no, I like it. Sam, do you have thoughts on this?
Yeah, I mean, I tend to agree with Derek in the sense that I think there are a lot of NFTs you can own. Like there's just a lot out there. So I think the question of what has a story behind it that's relevant, like a collectible owned by Al Capone or owned by people who don't have the greatest track record of history, but are at least notable, probably would increase it in value relative to all the other collectibles.
Are you saying Derek's not notable?
Oh, I mean, if Derek owned one, then I'm like double bidding. I think there is a story there. Like with all this stuff, just motion creates motion, and story is better than no story. I just think like when it comes, because there's so many NFTs out there, there's so much great art. Like, what are the pieces that are going to be relevant in 10 years? Like whether Three Arrow Capital enters that level of notoriety, I don't even know if it's true. You know, I don't like. It's an interesting story. I personally am grossed out by it because I lived in Hong Kong. These guys are based in Singapore. Hong Kong guys. I have a few friends I have a friend who worked for them. I have a couple friends who invested in them who lost a lot of their net wealth. They haven't got a single apology from Three Arrow Capital. Three Arrow Capital hasn't announced doing any. Hasn't admit that they did anything wrong. Three Arrow Capital wasn't investing their money. They were investing other people's money, other people's family savings that they spent years working for, and they lost it all, and they never said sorry, and they're tweeting poetry about oysters. Like, I just think this is a dumb story of people who didn't deserve the attention that they got and who lost other people a lot of money, and were kind of like just kind of an illusion. So to me, it's not that exciting of a story to get excited about, but you know, I'm phrasing the story Derek just said about going toe-to-toe with the market and the technology. Like, I don't know. I find these guys a bit more criminal than that. But that's just, because I have
agree.
A personal connection to the story.
I don't disagree. I think we would largely fall in the same camp there. I guess the last point I'll make just from my end is, you know, the fact that they were able to, I think part of the story that's being missing here, as I describe it, is they worked with a group that was, you know, driven by Vincent Van Dell, who's one of the largest NFT collectors in the world and who has set the trend on a number of different artists and collections. And there is a really powerful narrative there when you've got the largest fund in the world, one of the largest holders of many of the top blockchain projects, working with one of the sharpest NFT collectors in the space with and to provide capital and size to be able to put on positions on what Vincent Van Dough and his team believe to be the most culturally significant collections. There's a curation that went into that and a thoughtfulness, and it gets back to why I think Sotheby's is calling this project Grails.
Yeah.
And it's because through provenance, through this information that exists on chain, we have a track record of Three Arrows Capital, the creation of their wealth, some of that being transferred for the sole purpose of finding and identifying cultural objects through Vincent Van Dough. Mm-hmm. Vincent Van Dough putting these positions on and taking a sophistication and a point of view around those collections, acting as the great filter or the curator, and then bringing them and paying, sparing no price to find the best in every collection. That to me is a story that I think collectors will collect around.
Yeah. Yeah. I think also, going back to our discussion around liquidity and volume, collectors know that there's, I think, 31 Fidenzas, for example, that will ultimately be sold through Sotheby's from the 3AC collection. That's true of many of these other collections as well, meaning ringers and, mm-hmm. and otherwise. And so, maybe we're seeing sort of people wait for those to ultimately be sold through Sotheby's, where maybe you can get a discount in some cases relative to even accepting a WEETH bid. So I think we're going to see that happen, and yeah. that will perpetually affect probably sort of market efficiency beyond the sales that are happening there. Derek, from a collector perspective, or maybe Sam as well, like I'm seeing that that Fidenza 725 at the moment has a bid of 130K USD, Autoglyph 187, 230. I think, and there's an 18% buyer's premium on these purchases. It closes today, I believe, that this portion of the sale. Are those, like, is that a discount? Does that feel sort of appropriately priced? I don't have a really good sense.
I believe, so I need to go through and look at that, but is that Fidenza Micro?
Yes.
Then I think that is probably underpriced.
Yeah.
But I'd be curious to see where bids land as it progresses. I think that might be a 6 for Autoglyph, which would put that around, I think, fair market, maybe a little under fair market.
Mm-hmm.
I'd need to go in and look at these exact pieces in particular. I will say both of those are above the floor price for mm-hmm. those collections right now. But I would say maybe below where I would believe those would end up and settle at, just given the types and of assets that they are within these respective collections.
Yeah, that made sense.
What did you say the Autoglyph bid was, Eli?
230K USD at the moment.
Got it. Yeah. No, I mean that. I think that still puts it right around the floor. But my sense with all this stuff, again, the stuff I was saying there was just my personal bias, and I think, the bigger question here, just to touch on the auction stuff, like the prices they put as their estimates were like so low.
Yes.
It was almost like the original estimate for the Autoglyph was below the bid. Was below the actual, like the actual bid on OpenSea was higher than the high end of their estimate.
Did we ever?
Beginning. So, and I've talked to Michael about this. I think there's a strategy just around setting low estimates.
Yeah, can you unpack that for us, Sam? What did Michael? What was the strategy there when you chatted with Michael?
Oh, we didn't go deep in it. I just think there's a strategy here where they'd rather you don't want the prices to come in below your estimates, especially with something like this where it has to go. Like the seller here isn't going to say no, that's too low for me. Mm-hmm. Like the seller is an estate that just wants money and isn't like trying to time the market here. So I think for them, there's just like you just want there to be momentum. I think pushing things.
You want
higher,
attractive prices to drive people in, and then you want the prints to be higher than the estimates.
Yeah, and you want the tweet to be, wow, we just got a bit above the range, but these ones are below. That's just my general sense. That's just me talking, not Michael talking. But I think there is, this is like a tying kind of the two conversations together here, I think is just, and when Seth comes in, I'm sure he'll have views here as well. But I think is tying the kind of the art blocks and this conversation with 3 Arrow Capital is what we're all trying to figure out what are the things that are going to be relevant in 5 years. In 10 years, in 15 years. And I think with art blocks, that's what's so hard for me. Like, I love Meridians. Is that going to be relevant in 5 years? I love Memories of Chile. And is Emily's work going to be relevant in 5 years? You love Subscapes. You love all these different pieces of art, but it's very hard to know. Like, we are going to get more attention, but we're also going to get more art, And I think that is the calculus that, Derek, you always have such good insight into whenever we chat on Telegram or when we chat on the show. There's so much out there and there's so much great stuff out there.
Yeah.
And I think that, that like just understanding what are the things we want to focus on, because right now you kind of have to play the 5-year game. Like flips aren't available right now. There's just, we're seeing people cross 20% bid-ask spreads, you know? So you really have to be playing the long-term game as far as what's going to get relevance as that more money comes in. And I think that's the hard part. And it relates to both these conversations. Like, is 3-Hour Capital, is Starry Night, VVD has touched so much art. Like, is this
a great question? You
know, is the fact that he paid over $3 million for a ringer a good thing? Like, awesome to get to buy that at, you know, a 90% discount to what he paid. I don't know. So those are some of the questions on my mind.
Great questions.
Yeah.
Sam has all the answers, or Eli has all the answers. So I'll let him jump in here.
No, let's, to your point, Sam, let's bring in Seth from Bright Moments.
Let's go.
Seth, are you around? Are you there?
Hello, hello.
Hey, there he is. Seth.
The legend.
So for those who do not know, Seth is the founder of Bright Moments. I don't know what, aside from founder, what else do you call yourself a Bright Moment, Seth?
Old man.
The guru.
Yeah.
They call you the guru when you turn your back.
What makes someone old in this space? I would say I'm 41. I say I'm old in this space, you know, but I feel like it's a moving scale.
Seth, actually,
over 50.
It might be helpful, Seth. I mean, you've done a lot of amazing things, and I don't know if folks know that. So maybe take a couple minutes before we jump into Tokyo and Japan and the amazing work you're doing at Bright Moments to talk a little bit about yourself and your history, and because you've been working on some very cool stuff for a very long time.
Yeah.
Thank you. Have two grown sons, more or less grown, Jacob and Charlie. So those are probably my biggest achievements. Mm-hmm. I started young during Web One. I was, you know, mid 20s. I was in New York. We called it Silicon Alley, and I started an early web marketing company called Site Specific that was actually named after some of the experimental theater stuff I was doing. Mm. You know, in high school and college, I went to college in New York at Columbia and studied avant-garde theater and performance art, and that kind of was kind of my lever into technology in a weird way, trying to put the archives of contemporary artists on, at the time, the only kind of digital media format, which was CD-ROMs. So like early 90s, before the web really opened up and became commercial. And then when the web hit, even though I think in Europe and Germany in particular, there was a lot of support for digital media, in the States, in New York, and obviously Silicon Valley, it was all about the consumer internet. And so I really focused on that. And I was a Web 1, Web 2, and now Web 3, you know, entrepreneur. Importantly, back then, after I sold Site Specific in the late 90s, I went to work with Fred Wilson and Jerry Colonna, who had started Flatiron Capital. And I was an entrepreneur in residence there and got a front row seat at a real bubble deflating. Mm. So whatever we think we're going through in these crypto markets and with NFTs, and it's not nearly as catastrophic. Mm. And the bid ask spreads were way more than, you know, mm-hmm. crossing 20%. Mm. So I have some pattern recognition there that I think helped. Coming out of that, you know, Web 2, I was, you know, there on the East Coast when Kevin was starting Dig. And Flickr and Delicious. I was an early investor in Delicious. Moved to California, co-founded a company, a really great company called Turntable FM.
Oh, yeah.
Some people remember that really tried, and there was a class of companies that tried to reinvent the listening experience online and make it more social. Ultimately, the labels took over, and you know, Spotify is an amazing product, but it's not, I don't think it reflects the kind of innovation that I would have liked to see in online music. And then, you know, more recently, you know, coming out of that, you know, did some early work on the Facebook ecosystem, doing social advertising in like 2007, 2008, before Facebook swallowed the world for those 10 years. And to make a long story short, ended up with Christy, my partner. We met in San Francisco. We moved to Venice Beach a couple years ago. I was completely done with startups and venture capital and, you know, a kind of capitalism that's kind of coming to roost that we've seen a lot of unintended consequences, sort of the growth at any cost mantra. And here in Venice Beach, you know, I'd been tracking NFTs and collectibles during the pandemic. I think like a lot of people, I was fascinated with what was happening with meme stocks and GameStop and the kind of powerful ownership tribalism that happened around that. I was tracking and buying and selling NBA Top Shot moments. And I think that, you know, moments obviously came to be used and influenced the name Bright Moments. And then at the beginning of 2021, and I was there for, you know, Bitcoin and Ethereum, never in a huge way, but obviously curious living in the Bay. You know, I saw when smart contracts came out and people were talking about them in 2014, it was always on the come. Then CryptoKitties and Punks, I didn't claim any. I saw them. It was kind of outside my what I was focused on. And then I also started a blockchain community center in San Francisco called Node. And I think it was there. Now, the ICO bubble burst, and so a lot of the mobility of all of these crypto entrepreneurs moving from community center to community center around the world never took shape. But I definitely got a sense of the kind of communities that you could form when tokens were involved, right? And this idea that we kind of take for granted of tokenized communities was a lot looser there because you didn't have NFTs as a kind of membership class the way we do now. But it's definitely something I took note of. And so flash forward to the beginning of, you know, 2021, you know, around the time that we met Derek, I was taking lots of photographs. Christy was painting lots of paintings. Super Rare and Foundation came out. I remember I was taking photographs of the sunset at Venice Beach using simple GAN models to turn them into synthetic videos. I showed it to Fred Wilson, you know, my old mentor, who maintains a place in Venice Beach and New York. And he said, oh, these are great. You should turn them into NFTs on Foundation. And so I was like, sure, it sounds fun. I got an invitation. I put something up and it sold. And it was a light bulb moment for me because, you know, with technology, things rarely happen twice if they're not going to happen forever. And I think with NFTs, there was a sense of, okay, 2017, these CryptoKitties and Punks happened. It could have been a one-off affair. When it happened again or when it bubbled back up and when we saw that explosion, you know, during JPEG summer, it just felt like, okay, this is here to stay. It felt like a really important creative unlock. And so increasingly, I just went all in emotionally. And it was never in the context of starting a company. You know, from the get-go, I wanted to build a DAO. I wanted to do it differently. And I wanted to use a native form of crypto governance to kind of regulate crypto tokens, right? It just felt right. And also, I didn't want to get involved with stock, you know, restricted stock and options and pitching venture capitalists and trying to pretend like I knew what was going to happen in 5 years and that everything was going to go up and to the right. And so as you remember, and I will always point this out, you called it the meat space.
I did.
There's something maybe in everyday life outside of a pandemic, it's not such a big thing, but meat space opportunities were so scarce a couple years ago.
Non-existent. Right.
And it was a radical thing to do, you know, sort of radical-ish to make an NFT gallery online, but to make an NFT gallery offline, it was kind of unheard of because it was almost like borderline illegal.
Yeah.
Right? Because the mask mandates were off and Venice is a bunch of crazy hippies and masks are off and we're out there on the boardwalk. But there was something very special about that time. And I think the combination of this new file format with this kind of energy that we tapped into in Venice Beach combined with, you know, a very fortunate but lucky collision with Art Blocks just created something special, and we've been kind of chasing the tail of this tiger ever since.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about all of the learnings that you've had going city by city and the lessons you've learned and the experiences and how it's been tailored for what I've heard to be an amazing experience in Tokyo. I'll just reflect quickly. I mean, you brought this up, Seth. The first time that we met was in early 2021. I had already invested in things like Super Rare and Art Blocks and a number of the marketplaces and galleries and infrastructure and software to support this, you know, this rise in digital objects and the 721 file format. And I remember after our conversation, I think we maybe spent an hour together, I was like, listen, there's obviously something interesting here, but we just don't invest in meat space. Like, this is just not what we do.
When you guys say meat space, what do you mean?
I just meant physical bodies in a location as an extension of the primitives of this technology, which to me are very clean. It's a trust minimized ledger. It's digital objects that sit on that ledger. It's a UI layer that allows people around the world, whether on their mobile devices or their computers, to engage with that ledger. What I fail to realize is that those invisible connections that we're making globally, whether it's pushing code to Bitcoin Core, or it's sending a transaction on the EVM, or it's engaging with a protocol, those invisible connections are actually quite powerful when you start to see them realized in human form with other people. And I remember I was living down on the beach at the time. I walked over to the Venice Bright Moments, Seth, to hang out with you for a couple hours just to see the thing in real life after we had already passed on investing. And I had this like light bulb moment where like I went through the minting flow. I got to spend time with you. I got to talk with other collectors. And I realized like there is something special about teasing out these connections that are on the internet and actually creating a product and a platform that exists in the real world, which I think has led to a lot of the secret sauce and the template and the playbook as you've gone through city by city. So full disclosure, I'm now very much a member of the DAO and a big fan of what Seth is building, but it took some time for me to really grok exactly why this was special. But once it clicked, it clicked. But I'd love to turn to you, Eli, and get your take here.
Well, yeah, Seth, I didn't realize that you had that that background. Can you take us back to was Tokyo that was City 7? Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, so take me back to city or experience number one. I saw you post something, I think, on Twitter that had perhaps what was the first instantiation of this adjacent to the Tokyo experience. Take us back to that very first moment, that first minting experience that you guys had. What were you trying to accomplish, evoke in people? And ultimately, what do you think sort of started to emanate from that experience?
So, you know, as Derek knows, because Derek and Steven really helped us architect the DAO that's now Bright Moments, that's entirely made up of these crypto citizens that we mint 1,000 per city. If we go back to the beginning, Tokyo was the 7th city, but the 6th real world city. Like the first city is we call it the Crypto Galacticans, but really that's the original DAO. Because when we started, we were ERC-20 tokens, sort of conventional DAO, not an NFT DAO. And the idea was to use these ERC-20 tokens to govern a somewhat decentralized physical art, you know, NFT art gallery. And we organized around that. We got a space in Venice Beach. And our first show was with Jeff Davis, who's the creative officer at Art Blocks. And he's been an artist in every single one of our cities. And so that experience of sort of city number zero, or city number one, you know, as it were, in Venice before we did the Crypto Venetians was all about this meat space, right? All about, and I think what a lot of us take for granted, or maybe some people took for granted, is that, you know, artists are not robots. I mean, maybe some AI will be, but in the end, Jeff Davis, even though he makes these beautiful, you know, minimalist Donald Judd, like light sculptures, and they're perfectly geometrical and abstract. He's a great guy with a great wife from, you know, who lives in Phoenix, and he's an artist and he wants to have an opening. Right. And that was the lure. It wasn't, hey, work with Bright Moments and we'll do another drop online outside of your Art Blocks drop. It was, you know, come to Venice Beach. We're sort of open ish in between COVID, you know, lockdowns. you know, let's do a show on a Thursday night, you know? And so that was really how we started. And it was through that process that, you know, we realized the insight was, well, okay, we're going to have shows every so often. And that'll be great. But what do we do in between shows? You know, it's 3 o'clock on a Tuesday in Venice Beach. How do you get someone to show up at a gallery? Now, is it enough to show, you know, Beeple Everydays and LeBron James Top Shot? Maybe, maybe not. You know, I think a lot of people have tried to just put NFTs on screens with a QR code and say we're open for business. And maybe at the height of the bubble, it worked for a little bit. But I think it was clear back then that that wasn't going to be enough. And so, you know, we needed to get creative about marketing and driving foot traffic. And so we said, okay, why don't we give away NFTs for free? People hopefully will pay the gas. So the gas was going to be $30 or $40 to mint a Crypto Venetian, which was our homegrown version of CryptoPunks. We said, okay, we'll do 1,000 Crypto Venetians. We'll mint them only to people that show up at the gallery. And lo and behold, because we were already working with Jeff for his show, he's like, oh, you could use ArtBlocks for that. And none of us really knew about ArtBlocks, and none of us were steeped in 20-year tradition of, you know, off-chain generative art, although I'd like to believe we were. It just seemed like a good idea, and he introduced us to his partner, Snowfro. And so we had some conversations, and Phil and Chan and others like came up with this project, number 95 on ArtBlocks, which were the Crypto Venetians. And what was unique about them, other than the fact that they were sort of these pixel art portrait PFPs that hadn't been done on ArtBlocks before and were truly generative, was that you had to be there in person. And the way we forced that is you couldn't buy a token online to mint them, that you had to show up in person to the gallery. We transferred 10 BRT ERC-20 tokens to your wallet. They weren't on Uniswap. There was no liquidity pools. They were in our wallets as a DAO. And you'd come in, you'd mint your Crypto Venetian, and you'd walk out from the back, and we'd play it on the big screen, and it was like a day party. And initially, it was very technical and bro-y, and Christy was like, you know, make this like a dager. And so Amicia, her daughter, put on a bikini, and Charlie, my son, was DJing, and my other son, Jacob, was hyping people up and back, and it became an experiential thing because we didn't know what else to do, and it was fun. And people, and what was strange through all this is two things. One is the experience of revealing generative art, in this case, your character in person for the first time, you know, with the artist, is a thing.
Yeah.
And we never would have known this unless we had tried it. And it brought some joy to a pretty joyless time, and people felt hopeful. You know, the metaverse was a thing. People were excited about bringing, you know, bringing their characters to life. We had weird improv sessions around when people minted their characters, evening workshops where you'd give them voices in the Hollywood setting. It was like ridiculous, but it was fun, and there was no money attached. They were free, right? And it was really a struggle to think whether people would pay the gas. And then what started to happen is people, there were ArtBlocks collectors in Singapore or Switzerland who couldn't travel, but made it a thing. They were completionists. So they had every single ArtBlocks drop up through number 94, and they saw this thing come out of the minter, number 95. And they're like, what the fuck is that? I want one. And the only people that had them were skateboarders and surfboarders coming in and off the Venice boardwalk, who had walked into our gallery because we had a sandwich board sign that said, you know, come in for free NFTs. And so there was a weird crypto mule culture of the Venice locals selling these things that they got for free for $500.
Oh, interesting.
You know, for $1,000, for $2,000, right? And we didn't really, it was a little bit like Mickey in the Night Kitchen or the Sorcerer's Apprentice, where we didn't know what was going on. But suddenly people started traveling to collect these things for free. And then one day, I think August 1st, Bob Iger walked through a friend of a friend. He minted number, you know, Crypto Venetian number 540 or something like that.
And Seth, for those who don't know, Bob Iger, well, now again, CEO of Disney. Yeah.
Yeah. So he came through, he minted his Crypto Venetian. Suddenly, words like floor price became more prevalent. It doubled. And we knew we were onto something, you know, that we had, there was a pulse and it was exciting and it was weird because we were giving away, you know, magic internet money. But, you know, some of us were, you know, in our 20s, some were older, you know, I knew that these things this doesn't come around very often. There was a lot of goodwill. There was a lot of community formation around it.
And you and Derek were in your 20s back then.
Yeah.
Truly.
Yeah.
Both of us.
We had some really good counsel. Like, I think, you know, Derek and Steven, Aaron Wright, Fred Wilson got involved.
Yeah.
Jess Sloss, Cooper Trooper.
Yeah. It was a good group.
And
it
so
was a good group.
It was a really good group. And it was a very special time where we all felt really hopeful about crypto. And we could say NFTs and not feel embarrassed, right? And it wasn't because we were all greedy. We were just really optimistic and positive about the creative opportunities to be more self-sustaining. You know, we never raised money. We never had any venture capitalists. We were just doing what we were doing and having fun, and people were buying into it. And when we decided to sort of extend this roadmap and say, okay, well, we're never going to mint more than 1,000 in one location because it takes, you know, we could only do 20 or 30 a day. We said, okay, well, maybe, you know, 10,000 is the canonical number of PFPs. There's 10,000 CryptoPunks, right? There's 10,000 apes. And we said, okay, well, let's tune this DAO to do 10,000 of these crypto citizens across 10 different cities and then call it a day. And so if, you know, CryptoPunks minted out in a couple hours, you know, Bright Moments crypto citizens will mint out in 3 years.
Yeah.
And so we are 7,000 citizens done through what will be 10,000 once we get through Buenos Aires in October, city number 9 in February, and then the last city number 10 will be Venice, Italy next April.
Amazing. And Seth, when you say call it a day, what does that mean for you?
You know, I think a lot of people want to know and have ideas about what should come after the 10th city. What's cool about being a project as opposed to being a company is this project and this product in particular, which are the crypto citizens, as Derek puts it, like, it was designed for completion. It doesn't mean that Bright Moments doesn't continue to thrive and provide value to the community. It just means that we will have completed this roadmap for this particular product, which is minting crypto citizens to people in each city to get to 10,000. The business model that we came up with is really interesting, which is for every city, you know, take Tokyo, we sold 333 mint passes to mint a crypto Tokyoite. We airdropped 333 to the 6,000 existing holders. So you had a 333 over 6,000 chance of getting a free crypto Tokyoite mint. And then we gave away locally to the local Japanese community in Tokyo 334 free mint passes to come and mint a crypto Tokyoite. And we do that in each city to kind of institutionalize a kind of diversity, you know, economically, regionally, you know, psychographically as well.
This is awesome.
I have so many follow-ups, but go
ahead.
I
would be curious to hear, Seth, as you've gone through city by city and you've interacted with folks who are locals to each of the cities that you've done these drops in. I'm curious how their response has been past the city. Like, have these individuals become core members of the DAO? Are they participating by going to additional cities in the future? I'm curious to hear a little bit about the interactions that you've had locally and whether that has expanded globally for those members as time has gone on.
It's probably been the most awesome, rewarding thing in all this, honestly. Because I spent a lot of years as an entrepreneur hearing a lot about community, but sort of dismissing it as being something intangible and something that was like, you know, in the internet community is like chat rooms. But, you know, there's something that's been so visceral and real about this period of meeting people, I think for all of us in the space, but definitely within the Bright Moments kind of ecosystem, because there was a really clear beginning date that coincided with the end-ish of a really traumatic period for all of us. You know, it was kind of like post-war. It was post-pandemic. And so we all, for those 2 years, stopped all the traveling and stopped where we were going and settled down into one place. And we were all lonely in very small groups. And we met a lot of people online, right? So it was all this like pent-up social connectivity that we were feeling, but it was only digital. It was in our heads. And so I remember when we went from Venice to do the Crypto New Yorkers, and we got a lease on an amazing Worcester Street gallery in New York, where we did a Jeff Davis show called Reflections. We did Tyler Hobbs' Incomplete Control, and we minted 1,000 Crypto New Yorkers. And I remember that it was an amazing mix of local New Yorkers who were joining the project and minting their New Yorkers, but then also these Venice community folks from LA that had gotten free airdrops and made the travel and came to New York and minted. And the feeling of meeting, of sort of meeting new people in New York while you're also seeing people from 6 months ago that you minted, that in a way, I mean, thanks to you and Stephen, our roadmap and our distribution model for the tokens institutionalized this kind of experience. Hmm. And then when we went to Berlin, it was hard to get to Berlin. Right, the war had broken out with Ukraine. This was, you know, April of last year. The war had broken out. COVID was still a thing. Berlin was just coming, you know, out of COVID restrictions. And there's no direct flights from New York or LA to Berlin, or there wasn't at the time. And so we were in this huge warehouse at Kraftwerk, 80,000 square feet. We were minting crypto Berliners, but we were also minting 10 artists that kind of formed the Berlin collection. And every once in a while, there'd be, you know, mostly Germans, and then someone would show up off the plane, you know, from LA, or someone would show up from New York. And I remember, you know, Stephen, your partner, was there, you know, every, you know, for the first, whatever, 3 or 4 nights at Kraftwerk, minting his citizens. And it just felt, it felt familiar and new at the same time. It felt very human. It felt really good. And then you compound that when we went to London and we had chance encounters with people from London, but also people from Berlin and people from New York and people from LA. Some people had gone to every single one of them, right?
Yeah.
And so in each community, we're carrying forward community members who show up at the next city. We're also meeting people that join the team, right? And so in Berlin, we met, in New York, we met Future Ace Keith, you know, who runs Tokenomics. Who's probably, you know, the guru of gurus on Dutch auctions. In Berlin, we met Malta. You know, who's
Love
a really
Malta.
Important curator of ours and works with, you know, with Glitch Gallery. In London, we met Samir, you know, Spongenuity and his wife Hanan that helped run that sub DAO. In Mexico, we met Leo, who runs a sub DAO there. In London, we met Finger Code, right? So it's like every, you know, in London, we... You know, proof of people was happening. And so we met a lot of the Tez artists. We met Zancan there. We met Seifert. We met Kim Assendorf, Andreas Giesen. You know, I remember they came to mint their Londoners. And while they were doing that, they were minting on FX Hash because they had to push out a release. And like, what's this FX Hash? Right. And next thing you know, Kim is part of Tokyo. And we're doing FX Hash shows in Mexico. So, each, you know, the roadmap that's sort of conditioned by these tokens and conditioned by this distribution plan has driven these really great collisions and interactions with artists and collectors. And Tokyo was the best one yet. I mean, Tokyo brought that to a boil.
Yeah.
And
Seth, I've
heard still living off the high.
I've heard you describe Tokyo in those terms a couple times now as sort of this coalescing of all things Bright Moments to date. Why did it feel like that to you? I mean, I can say from my perspective, the contrast between the generative art minting experience at the Asakura house, which is this 100-year-old heritage building, very sort of quiet and a whole experience in and of itself, contrasted with the lively, energetic digital garage minting and citizen minting in the evening with music and dancing and drink, as I've told Derek and others, really felt impactful as this representative moment of a movement. But from your perspective, why did Tokyo maybe feel like a special moment?
I mean, it was the most involved, you know, event yet. Like, it took a real 6 months. And there was also a lot of excitement for Tokyo, you know, from the team, from the artists, you know, from the community. You know, we, in addition to the generative collection, which was the Tokyo collection, you know, which was, you know, Takuo and Kabibi and Zankan and Lars and Kettle and Melissa and others, Spontaneity, Kim, Jeff, probably leaving out.
I think you almost got all.
One other. Lee Shahi.
You're getting an angry email from somebody after this.
Somebody. This is the 10th or 11th one. It should be 10, but it's always 11 because we have to include Jeff Davis in every city, right?
I'm into Jeff. I love my piece.
We also, you know, we invited AI artists to participate, and we just reached out to the top list that we could think of, and they all said yes because of Tokyo. I mean, yes because of Bright Moments, but people wanted to be in Tokyo, so we felt that. And I think, you know, by fusing, you know, great workshops, you know, Matt Desi did a workshop.
Yes.
Most of the artists were there talking about their recently minted work. Great food. You know, every night was a really interesting dinner, and one was on boats. One was at a kind of a brutalist Omotesando gallery space, you know, with Pace Gallery. The last night was in, you know, the Yokocha street food. So it wasn't a bunch of one-off things. Everything built, and the minting experiences were special, right? Yeah. And we still think of, and the problem with Blur, and there's so many benefits, is it makes you think that NFTs are little profile pictures that are like pork bellies.
Yeah.
And I think what we're devoted to at Bright Moments is showing that, like, there's so many ways to experience art that fall outside of the box.
Yeah. God, we could continue for hours talking about this. I'll say a couple of things, and then I know we're near the end of the show, so I'd love to get your final thoughts on where Bright Moments is going. But I think the thing that I reflect on every time we connect, Seth, and every time, you know, I've watched the product and the platform and the citizen and the DAO just continue to expand its vision under these very tight constraints is there's this old, you know, childlike video game called Katamari, where you start off as this little ball and you start picking up the things around you. It could be like a leaf, or it could be, you know, a litter on the street, or it could be, you know, something else. And then over time the ball gets bigger and it starts to pick up a trash can, and then it starts to pick up a street sign, and then it starts to pick up, you know, a big tree, and until, you know, eventually you're starting to pick up, you know, full blocks and then full cities and then the entire earth. And all of a sudden you're starting to pick up stars and galaxies. And it feels like the tight constraints around the DAO and the citizens have led to very creative results around how the product and the vision and the people in the DAO have expanded over time. But everyone just sticks around for the next thing. And it just continues to get bigger into things like Tezos art, or AI art, or, you know, what it means to play with the live experience, into food and into these locations. And so it's just I'll just say it's been awesome to watch you work and to watch this thing take on a life of its own, and the people be the through line as it continues to persist and get bigger. So great work, Seth, and awesome to watch this thing unfold. And I guess maybe in the last 30 seconds would be great to hear, you know, your final thoughts on Bright Moments and where you think this thing will end up.
We're on to Cincinnati, which is the football reference from Bill Belichick. We're on to Buenos Aires, you know, every city has to be different. Every city has to show you that you can experience crypto art in really fundamentally different ways that changes your assumptions. And so, you know, from Berlin, which was monumental, to London, which was tiny, to Mexico, which was festive and spiritual, to Tokyo, which is, you know, as you pointed out, was, you know, cyberspace, you know, Blade Runner meets, you know, historic, you know, Meiji temple Zen art. I think Buenos Aires is going to be more outside. It's like the, you know, going, you know, as Phil put it, you know, from Tokyo to Buenos Aires is about going from the middle of the world to the end of the world. And how do we lean into South America as a continent and South American artists and give them a voice and help them teach others how to do generative art, how to do AI art, you know, in Spanish, how to create deeper conversations between artists themselves and with collectors and just make it flow beautifully, and then do something outside. Awesome. You know, I think the challenge for us now is like, how do we think about the natural landscape? Mm. So can you do things that are on chain, but offline, as it were, and think about, you know, not just 5 or 10 years, but how do you create things for, you know, 10,000 years in the future?
Well, we're excited to see what you cook up, Seth. Big fans of the product here. And thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. Yeah, thanks so much, Seth.
Eli, Sam, if you're still around, this has been an awesome one.
Yes.
Glad to get you guys in the booth here. And we'll continue with another awesome 100 Proof next Friday. Take it easy, guys.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, guys.